This is Packer and Durham on ACCN and SiriusXM Channel 371.
Dallin Cuff is along for the three-hour tour today. Great to have you with us, Wes Durham. And, of course, you've got us on the ESPN app, the ACC Network, SiriusXM 371, ACC Radio as well here. Good program today. Bottom of the hour, Matt Park is going to be here, the radio voice of the Syracuse Orange. We'll kind of get a feel for maybe where Syracuse is headed here from a perspective of a quarterback choice, Tommy DeVito, Garrett Schrader, Jacobian Morgan, and maybe some other guys to keep an eye on. They open at Ohio, by the way. And Coach Babers made the note last week. Dallin, Ohio brings back the bowl team for the last 5 years and like 16, 17 starters. He goes, this is not your MAC road game layup that everybody perceives it to be on paper. Danny Cannell will be along as well. And Manny Navarro, the athletic, will talk about the U. Good to see you, my man. How you been? Things all right? You dialed in on the Olympics. We got some Olympic soccer. We got Olympic – hey, U.S. beat Iran by 60. We got a win, Dallin.
Got a win, and they took you to Cover City, 40-point spread there. But it's good to be with you, Wes. I do want to say if my man Pack is watching, Pack, we're all thinking about you. Hope you keep getting healthy. But I'll stand in here for these 3 hours. Hopefully we'll have a couple laughs, have some fun. And, been locked in the Olympics has been great. It's fun. I don't remember being this locked in the Olympics before I got the chance to work there and be part of NBC's team down there in 2016
sure.
in Rio and love that experience. And I think maybe it got into me, man, because up to like Thursday at like 8 p.m. of last week, I was like totally checked out on what was going on. And then I watched the opening ceremonies just because more of to see what was going, like what that would look like with nobody there. It was a weird television event. But all of a sudden, right. I was juiced up. I was ready to go. And now I'm all in all types of events. Love the swimming. Handball's always fun. Obviously, gymnastics, a lot going on there. It's been a fun time when I just didn't expect I would be that locked in the Olympics. So it's been cool.
Yeah, no doubt. We're trending toward the start of football as well. Practices scheduled to begin next week at some of the campuses in the ACC footprint. And, of course, the opening week is 5 weeks from tomorrow is typically where those first games fall, the September 2nd night. That Thursday night, Pack and I'll be in Raleigh that morning for NC State South Florida. That's on ACC Network that night as well. We're going to ask an interesting question here at the top. We put it to a poll, Dallin. That is, when does football season start for you? I saw this question yesterday, and I like the idea, but I'm not sure I can give it a definitive answer because it tends to vary with the year. Like, sometimes football season will start. Like, for me, I go to an NFL training camp practice on Saturday morning for the first time. So, technically, that's football season starting for me, I guess. But if you're a fan, when does football season start? Is it when the magazines come out for the college and the pros, like June, or is it – you know, is it when the tickets get there in the mail? I think it's a really interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, for me, in all honesty, and I grew up in Pittsburgh, and my parents went to Duquesne, so I was not a Pitt guy. I know that's maybe, blasphemous to say right now, but that just is what it is. For me, I was always following the Steelers, always been NFL, and because the NFL games have their preseason games are televised, and there are preseason games, that's like when it clicks in my head. When you're sitting there in August, yeah. Usually the Hall of Fame game, the first one, it's like that first couple of days of August. I'm like, whoa, okay, here we go. Like, you start to be aware of it, and you talk about it more, and obviously we talk about it more in the collegiate sense. But when I first see that first game, that kind of clicks in my head, and you really start to turn the page. You guys already had media days last week, and there's all these conversations. But when you first see those guys with pads hitting each other at any level, that's when it clicks for me.
Yeah, that's a good point. We put a poll on ACC Network, at ACC Network on Twitter, and folks kind of locked in on week one. 68% of the people that voted said week one is when football season officially starts. Preseason poll for 18%, that's typically 2-3 weeks out. Spring game 7.5, schedule release 7%. Well, the schedule release now... I'll tell you, that could be in February. Is that when football starts, when the schedule release comes out? Wow, that's early. Week one, though, to be honest with you, I was a little surprised it was that late for some folks.
I don't know if that should be prescriptive on how we handle a lot of our shows, that if people aren't locked into week one, maybe we should do things a little differently in August. But hey, what do I know? But I was a little surprised by that, too.
Right. All right. So other news here this morning. We'll pass this along because of an ACC nature. UVA swimmers Alex Walsh and Kate Douglas won silver and bronze, respectively, in the 200 IM in Tokyo. So congratulations to the Virginia swimmers on their accomplishments. Nice wins for Alex and Kate to kind of keep the medal count coming for the ACC in Tokyo. Virginia, of course, took a half dozen swimmers, including their coach and more, to Tokyo for the competition. So good to see Alex and Kate come away with medals in the 200 IM. The news over there has been dominated by Simone Biles in the last 24 hours. Dallin, almost fortuitous you're here with us. We talked a lot about athletes and mental health, and it seems like Simone Biles has pushed this conversation even further down the road with the election not to compete in the team competition. And then overnight, the announcement she will not try for the individual medals as well in Tokyo. I think that people, I heard Michael Phelps last night on their coverage with Mike Tirico, and he's also talked about mental health and particularly with athletes. But I heard Michael Phelps last night go a long ways to talking about the platform that Simone Biles is on and the journey she may be on when you just mentally don't think you can pull the trigger, so to speak, and compete in the Olympic Games.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing about this topic is it obviously is nuanced as it relates to Simone Biles. Mental health and the issues around that and our desire, our need to give attention to that and the right weight to that is unquestionable. That is goes without saying, and Michael Phelps can uniquely speak to that, Wes. I mean, that Olympic pressure is different than when we're talking about when we see Patrick Mahomes or Tom Brady playing the Super Bowl. That's a big deal. But those guys have already made generational money. They'll have another chance next year. You play in a game one Sunday, in game week 10, you have week 11. That doesn't exist here. You build up all these years of work, hours and hours. They did that feature in Katie Ledecky last night. She swum 35 million miles, or 22,000 miles. That's like almost around the planet. She's done 35 million meters, like in terms of training to get here, and she's in her early 20s. All that builds to this. So with Simone Biles, unfortunately, I think in our society right now, everything becomes black or white, red or blue, left or right. And this has become boiled down to that. People either respond that, oh, she's soft, she quit on her teammates, or it's being lauded as the most courageous thing you've ever seen. Where I think the truth is somewhere in the middle, as in all these issues are, there's nuance to this. And with this situation, there's a couple things here. I just mentioned it's literally unparalleled pressure with outside of maybe Michael Phelps, the only person that can truly understand what she's going through at this point in time. Secondly, when she said to her teammates, that's a team competition. And she said, I don't want to do something stupid. I don't trust myself. She didn't thought she was going to hurt the team. So she's taking herself out of the equation, thinking she's going to hurt the team. And let's not forget, when you're flipping through the air like that, and they mentioned on the coverage, she didn't know where she was in the air, you can seriously hurt yourself if you don't trust in what you're doing. She's having a crisis of confidence with a lot of athletes. I've had it myself, but it's shooting a basketball. If I'm not going to make a shot, Wes, I'm going to be bummed, but I'm not going to crack my skull. Like there's some serious, you know, issues that can happen if she doesn't believe what she's doing. All that said, I totally respect her decision. I personally don't understand it. I would have thought I would find a way to want to play and want to perform, but that's just me with complete ignorance. So that's where I think a lot of people are speaking from, is complete ignorance. We don't know. I think how I would have reacted as a former athlete, but I have no clue what those pressures are like, what that feels like. And it is a team competition. She stepped out of that. Her team won silver. And now she's not even going through with the individuals, which says that, yeah, this is a real big issue. And she has to do work on herself mentally. And I feel awful for her because literally the world's at her fingertips if you can overcome that. And she could have been able, maybe better prepared going into it. And Michael Phelps spoke to this, having people there to help you through it, to talk you through it, and work with you for years on the mental side, just like they do on the physical side. It doesn't seem like that's really set up for U.S. athletes to have that chance to be vulnerable and talk about their concerns, to work through these things so it doesn't happen literally on the biggest stage you're going to have in your life and it implode in front of you because it's too much, and that's understandable.
Dallin, it brings to mind all the things we're getting ready to embark on here in what we hope to be a very normal collegiate season, right? In athletics, at least. Last year, we did it with limited to no crowds. We did it in a unique way where there was a lot of testing. And while there still may be some of those hurdles we have to navigate, it's readily evident, and this is what I gleaned from the Michael Phelps visit last night on their coverage, that we need to be mindful of college athletes returning to campus, to returning to some degree of normalcy. When you spent 16 months, 17 months staring at monitors and coaches' meetings in a unique way and masking to test and all the things that are transpiring, that puts another layer, if you will, on the competition, another layer on the preparation. And I'm not sure, as folks who cover the ACC, cover college athletics, cover sports, I'm not sure we have given that its fair due in terms of the way we evaluate what transpired ultimately in competition.
I think that's a fair point. I think a lot of our coaches in this league reflected that. I remember Mike Noonan right after they won the ACC championship in the fall last year. Yep. What's the emotion you're feeling most? He said relief. And not about it's just about the process we went through and that our guys made it here. They had issues. They had guys get sick, but guys recovered and it was okay. And that was just a chance to exhale, because every coach we talked to, the morning when you talked to your trainer was the most stressful part of your day. Who's in, who's out, who's healthy, who's not. And, yeah. and the unknowing, and for athletes too, to have to kind of suffer through that and never know how it's going to play out. And then you mentioned the social piece, to your point too, Wes, which is, I think we will study this years down the road and understand how it had affected these young men and women that are 18 to 22, how it affected kids that are 1 through 5 and everybody in between and above that. But there's certain really important developmental stages everybody goes through their life and from young adulthood to adulthood. And those things have been affected. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what those effects actually are and how hard that really was, especially for athletes, a lot of them in isolation in different ways and forms throughout the course of the last 18 months. So you're right. I think they will have to learn, but give the right credence to what those athletes went through. I think we talked about it a lot, but I don't think we can ever understand it. Like, kind of the same thing I was saying about Simone Biles. We can't really understand it because we didn't live it.
The Packer and Durham Podcast. Here's Mark Packer and Wes Durham.
Once again, I always say this, Dallin Cuff, the most well-read personality on ACC Network and has the bookshelf to prove it. I have books back here for decoration. Doesn't necessarily mean they've been read. I do have to ask this one question. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yours look great and they've been read, which is a whole nother concept. But all right, there's a book over your left shoulder about Churchill. Have you read that book? Because that book would have taken 2 months.
I was going to correct you. I was going to say I've read everything up here with the exception of Churchill. That will be next summer's endeavor. Unless I'm covering the women's Euros, which probably will happen. If that doesn't happen, then that is next summer's endeavor, because that thing is about 1,025 pages. I started to, my mom got it for me a couple years ago. I started to crack it. Interesting, and obviously polarizing figure when you look at him in today's context, but one of the greatest leaders, whatever you think about him, one of the greatest mm-hmm. leaders in the history of the sure. world in terms of like impact he had. So I'm very interested to read it, but that's going to require quite an investment of time.
Yeah, it is. I love biographies, and anybody who's as fascinating as that would be worth it, but I'm not sure 1,000 pages gets it done. All right, let's go to coordinators here, shall we? We touched on this going to break. There's a list here of second-year guys in the ACC. Some have second-year coordinators at a school. Well, in fact, two do. Kenny Dillingham, Adam Fuller are at Florida State, Sterling Gilbert, Tony White at Syracuse, Tim Lukaboo is the defense coordinator at Boston College, Rhett Lashley, been a lot of talk about he and Tim Beck for that matter. So that's the list of guys who are getting ready to be in their second year, either on the offensive or defensive side of the ball. Dallin, how much expectation do we have for improvement? What are the ceilings? Did they have enough to work with in year one, which was, as we've all said, a weird world? And we'll start with Tim Lukaboo at Boston College, because that guy came in, and where BC was at times just miserable in 2019 defensively, didn't rank higher than 10th in any of the major categories, They improved to be no worse than eighth in the five dominant categories. I mean, Lukaku did a phenomenal job and had a really, really good team.
Yeah, the biggest thing, Wes, I think with any time you have a new coaching staff come in any sport, it's building your foundation. You got to build your foundation. Here are the principles of our program. Here's what we value. Here's how you're going to conduct yourself off the field. Here's what we're going to do on the field. And you have to build that, and then you need results to help showcase that this path can work. And Lukaku, along with Coach Haley Halfley, have done this is a huge first year they had to set out and say, okay, here's what we're going to do. They improved in all these different areas. As you mentioned, in a very unique and difficult and challenging year, I believe because they were so great in their protocols and how their athletes handled it, I think they played 9 straight games before they got a bye week. Like they were grinding physically, right, Emotionally, and mentally throughout the course of that stretch there, and put up great performances. So I think they've done what they wanted to do in year one. Now that creates more expectation for year two. But I think you have that solid foundation where your players are bought in with a quarterback like Djurković. You're excited about what can come in the future. And that defense, I think, is now they have in year two. This is exactly where you want to be as you're building a new staff.
Well, they were 125 in 2019 in total defense nationally. They were 73rd last year. They were 101 in scoring defense in 2019. They were 60th nationally last year. You see the numbers as they relate to the ACC, but there is no doubt Tim Lukaku did a phenomenal job. Now, can he retool a little bit of that? Brandon Sebastian comes on the backside. Marcus Valdez is a defensive end. I mean, they've got some guys who have played a lot of football there, 2-3 year guys. That should certainly help. But no Isaiah McDuffie, no Max Richardson inside for Boston College. The story for Adam Fuller defensively at Florida State is going to be interesting, because you felt like Florida State was trying to get better last year, and they did some really good things. But it's going to be interesting, I think, to watch and see kind of how the Seminoles press forward here. You know, you look at where they were in 19, you kind of see where they were in 20. Weird year. They had moments, but they didn't have enough of them, and the numbers reflect that. Takeaways, yeah, you're down to 12th. You see when you're 12 or 13, that's not good. But then again, it was a weird year too, and some of that can be Florida State's scenario.
Yeah, this is actually the opposite of what I just said about Coach Lukaku and what's going on at BC, because this is not what you want to have happen if you're building out this first year. And obviously some of the issues started in the preseason with some comments, Mike Norvell, obviously Marvin Wilson going back and forth, and you didn't exactly have the ideal first year, without a doubt, at this program. And particularly defensively, because that was the one thing coming into the year. We knew there would be quarterback issues. They lost some talent on the offensive side of the ball. But we thought their defense would be good. Right. We thought their defense would anchor that team. So when you fall very short of those expectations, both as a player and as a first-year coach or first-year coordinator in this situation, you got a lot of introspection to do. You got to look at yourself in the mirror, figure out what you need to do better, how things need to change. And they need to have this. This has to be a really big year. I know we'll have Danny Cannell coming up later in the show. I mean, they have some pieces on both sides of the ball, but they have to see market improvement to help not just this season, but as you're trying to build, again, that foundation to get back to where Florida State's supposed to be. And expectations matter. And if we're not talking about the expectations for you know, a Georgia Tech. Granted, they've had a good program, had success in the past, but Florida State is a national brand, has won a national championship in the last 10 years. So when those expectations are out there, or your fan base believes you should be in that place, right, you have a lot of work to do in terms of building that foundation to get it right on track. Because right now, particularly the defensive side of the ball, they underperformed for their own expectations, I'm sure, and definitely for the outside's expectations.
19 starters are back for Florida State, offensively and defensively. 8 of them are on defense. The most notable guy there, in my opinion, is Amari Gaynor, who's got 14 career starts. Now, Emmett Rice and Robert Cooper have played a lot of football for Florida State. They're not household names, but if you follow Florida State, they're really good. But Gaynor is the guy. They do bring back 3 starters in the secondary as well. So you would hope for Adam Fuller that things are on the uptick for sure. Let's go to Syracuse, because, I think there was a lot of movement last year at Syracuse. Sterling Gilbert came in as the offensive coordinator. And when you turn and look at what Tony White was trying to do defensively there, he was hired in February of 20 after working at Arizona State. I think he came in, injuries kind of sidetracked him. Cisco, Melifonwu, guys like that, they had some bumps and bruises along the way. Statistically, they had to go young. And as a result, Dallin, Syracuse is going to come back with a lot of experience for young guys. It's still a very young defense by definition. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens in year two here for Tony White on the defensive side.
For sure. And I don't think I've given proper credence to how you've mentioned both times. It's a weird year. I mean, last year with how jacked up preseason was, how much work you could get in, the focus a lot of times being on your health or on things emotion. There are all these other factors than just let's build our foundation, let's start playing football, let's get better. So that should go without saying, but I have to reiterate it for all three of those teams. And Syracuse, I mean, obviously the same thing. They were coming with that 3-3-5 defense. He was trying to do something totally different. When sometimes your defense is really impacted by how good your offense is too. Can your offense hold the ball? Are they putting you in bad situations? So that stuff existed too. The Syracuse's offense really struggled. So that when you have that, it doesn't make anything easier on the defensive side of the ball. So it is one of the more interesting second years we have here because, in all honesty too, I mean, Dino Babers has to be feeling the pressure here. There's no doubt about it. We'll talk about Matt Park in a few minutes here, but this is a big year for Cuse and for Dino as the head coach, and they have to find some ways to get things right. They have all these pieces back. You have the full complement of your preseason to just focus ideally on football and get better and start the season on the right foot. Ohio is not a cakewalk by any stretch of the imagination when they go play that MAC team, but they need to come out of the gates on the both sides of the ball, particularly in defense, looking better than they did last year, without a doubt.
Packer and Durham. This is the Packer and Durham podcast.
So the U.S. gets a win in basketball. Holy cow. Matt Park here in just a moment. We found ourselves in an interesting conversation last week in Charlotte. I'll share this with you because, as you know, and I'm sure you've gotten we were all around each other for the first time really since the ACC tournament, right, in March 20. Remember when we all went to the ACC tournament, and that was kind of the last of the events, right? And it was an interesting dynamic, just how much things have changed. And we touched on that at the front, Dallin, how much stuff has changed in 18 months, and yet 18 months feels like 10 years in some respect, especially as it relates to what we're doing covering college athletics, right?
Yeah. I mean, beyond, like, society looks completely different. But, I mean, in college sports, you now have, obviously, NIL, the transfer policy, the Supreme Court decision, and on top of that decision, the scathing write-up, particularly by Brett Kavanaugh, about the model entirely, which is going to open it up to more litigation going forward beyond paying for educational expenses, maybe just pay-for-play, period. I mean, and now the SEC situation with Oklahoma and Texas, the world has changed, society has changed, how these players can mentally and physically, emotionally handle all this stuff is at the forefront, and the model of college sports probably is going to look totally different in 5 or 10 years. So, yeah, it's been quite an impactful 18 months in every aspect.
No doubt about it. Let's ride to Central New York. Matt Park is the longtime voice of the Syracuse Orange and good enough to dial us up here this morning. Good to see you. How you doing? Long time.
Good morning, guys. Hope you're having a great summer.
Yeah. Quick, Matt. Remember when summer we used to have like these definitive times off? They don't really live anymore, do they?
It does not. That's not how it works anymore in college sports. It's big business and never stops.
All right. Let me get to the elephant in the room here right out of the gate. Dino Babers talked about quarterback continuity in preseason practice. All the things he wanted to see from DeVito and Schrader and Jacobian Morgan. Taj Harris, in his interview with Kelsey and myself, talked about all three guys. Any way the hand is falling here before they start camp as to who you think might be the starter when you run out on the field in Athens, Ohio?
No, my stock answer to this point has been to expect that both Tommy DeVito and Garrett Schrader will play in the opener, maybe the first couple of games. Maybe it takes them a while to sort it out. Certainly the head coach wants to leave open any kind of mystery that he can that this may continue for any period of time, that it'll be hard to figure out who the starting quarterback is going to be. I find it hard to believe that it would be Jacobian Morgan, just to be fair and honest He's very inexperienced relative to the other two. DeVito's clearly the incumbent in my mind. He's got more time in the system. He lost his job last year due to injury, so he deserves the right to be in the lead car here. And then Schrader, with his athleticism, I think has something to offer. So I still am of the belief that both will play.
Yeah, the quarterback situation there is probably the most interesting thing, that not just because it's the position, but the rotation of it and how that all comes out will be important to see. But just in a more broad sense, Matt, give us a sense of what it's like on the ground there. Is there an anticipation, an excitement, a trepidation? What is the fan base like going into this season? And what's the pressure like on Dino Babers?
Well, it's very much show me. You know, this is a program that won one game last year. And, you know, I don't think anybody thinks they were one loss, you know, one win bad. Like, it's just that it was a lost year. The season got away from them really at the midway point, and they were not competitive in the last third or last half of the season for the most part. So there's been that anticipation to hit the reset button and start over. This is a much healthier program. It's a much deeper program than it's been in the last couple of years. And so there's definitely excitement to get it going. I think from the fan base's perspective, they need to be shown. They'll come back. They want to see the dome renovations and that type of thing that they were closed out from last year due to COVID. And let's see how the season gets going. They go on the road to a quality MAC program, home for a huge, you know, border kind of game against Rutgers. Then they got to beat Albany. They lost to Liberty last year, so that game's not a slam dunk. But the season has an opportunity to get off to a good start and build some momentum.
Matt, they're one of the teams. There are about three or four of them in the ACC that had struggles last year that I almost feel like the first month, you mentioned those four games, I feel like if they can come out of that 3-1, good heavens, 4-0, they're going to feel entirely different about themselves.
100%. There's no question about it. This is not a program that's had that positive feeling since the 2018 season where it won 10 games for the first time in two decades, and it's been a drop-off from there. I continue to say I'm just not making a big deal of last year. It's not good to win one game, but there was so unusual circumstances, the injuries, the opt-outs, the pandemic, just so much going on that the year is gone. And it's a matter of getting off to a better start to indicate right away that this year is different. They'll have their hands full at the start of the year. These games on paper look like, you know, Syracuse should be favored. You know, Liberty's going to have maybe the best quarterback they'll see on the field the entire season. Ohio's undergone a coaching
team. No doubt.
Won a lot of games. Rutgers is not going to overlook that game. You know, so those are all things that need to get their attention, and I think they will.
Yeah, that Rutgers game is important, too, from a recruiting standpoint, as Greg Schiano started to get some better recruits down there. Winning that tri-state battle is really important with young men choosing between sometimes Syracuse and Rutgers. We just had a discussion about second-year coordinators, and on the defensive side, we were talking about Tony White at Syracuse. Outside of takeaways, their defensive numbers were not that good. That last year, as we've said throughout the course of the show, and you just mentioned, it was a weird year, especially in year one, for him to be taking over that group. What needs to improve, and what do they feel better about on the defensive side of the ball as they move into year two under White?
Well, I just think they have a chance to implement what they're trying to do. We did a program here a few weeks ago with both of the coordinators. It was a special show for season ticket holders, and I asked them something to the effect of, was last year representative of what you were trying to accomplish? And they couldn't blurt out the words no, you know, faster. It just wasn't what they wanted to be. They didn't have time in a COVID camp with no spring football to implement their schemes. And yes, this team did have some takeaways. They've had takeaways really for the last 3 years running with lots of different coordinators on the defensive side. I expect that if it doesn't continue at that rate, it'll still be close. Offensively, the line improvement will have a great deal to say about what they're able to do. You can only go as fast as the slowest in this particular offense, and that's what they work on a lot, is the cohesiveness, the thoughts, you know, adjustments on the fly. Everybody's got to be on the same page because they're not huddling. They're just trying to rip it down the field. We didn't see a lot of tempo last year. They didn't play it because they didn't have the quarterback, didn't have the line to assemble the way that they wanted to. So I think this year at least we'll have an idea of, you know, what do you want to be? And it'll look more like it was intended by both coordinators and the head coach.
Matt, I want to go back to something. There are a lot of the preseason list, the list of starters at back at running back, and they only list Sean Tucker. Yet, I know you had opt-outs a year ago. Where's the running back situation stand in your mind with Tucker and other guys that may have come back and even new faces?
Well, the two opt-outs that you're referring to are Jarvion Howard and Abdul Adams, who basically were last seen in that ball game months and months ago against West Virginia at the conclusion of the 2018 season. Between the two of them, you've got injuries, opt-outs, and now they're ready to come back and go here. Abdul Adams hasn't played a lot of football. Various things have kept him off the field, but he clearly is capable. As long as he's healthy, he might be their best option. Plus, Sean Tucker got a lot of valuable experience and flashed some promise last year as a freshman. I want to say he's a little guy, but he's thick and he can run. Jarvion Howard's much bigger, would be maybe a short yardage threat in that area. So they have options there, two, three, four backs that they're willing to get in the game. Some of the younger guys, they're clearly recruiting better speed. That's what I think would be the goal as far as using the depth at the running back position to get playmakers on the field, find fresh legs, healthy legs, be able to withstand an injury if one should occur, and chances are they will. It's college football. So that's kind of where they are. I think that they're looking at that as the group has improved, even if the guys right now haven't had a ton of recent game experience.
Well,
Matt,
and
we touched
this
on the quarterbacks.
Probably the most valuable point. The most valuable point to follow in about Syracuse here is the quarterback situation will work itself out one way or the other. DeVito, Schrader, Morgan, Park, who knows, right? The idea, though, is they're only going to be as good as the offensive line. The wide receiver situation is always explosive. But guys like Aaron Service has got 48 career starts. I mean, in some ways, he's got to be the best player on the team in some respect, I think.
Well, he is a leader. There's no question about that. You know, you guys were starting in the lead in here talking about NIL, and it's a new world in college sports. Well, it's a new world in lots of ways. And one is this idea that somebody could make 50 or 60 starts in a college career. That was unheard of prior to some of the recent changes in laws relative to COVID and some of these other things with transferring. So Aaron Service will play a lot. He could play anywhere on the line. I think it's most likely that he will play tackle. And they have options there and experienced players. You know, we felt last year for a kid named Chris Bleich, who was a transfer from Florida. He started there.
Yeah.
And last year was the only player in America to transfer between schools and not get a waiver. I mean, everybody and their brother is transferring from one school to another for whatever reason and is playing right away. And now that's the rule. Now everybody can do that. Bleich was forced to sit out last year and Syracuse paid for it. They had injuries early in the year. Their two starting guards that they intended to have all year barely played at all. Now you've got a fullback playing guard and it went downhill. So it's just not, you know, last year's line was not representative of what they were trying to do. And I think this year will be closer to that.
Matt, we've touched on a number of different position groups now, but one of the things, obviously you guys have such better insight on covering the team, being there. And spring ball's a couple months ago now, so there's some other players that have emerged and had good workouts in the summer as you get ready to start camp here. Are there other players that folks need to be aware of, or a player that you're just excited to see that people need to be aware of that could have a big season?
You know, I think for me, it would be on the defensive side. It would be guys who last year, you know, led the stat sheet in takeaways, like a Garrett Williams, who was, you know, unknown really at this time a year ago and played significantly as a freshman in the opening game and kept it right up the whole year at corner. I think he's a really good player and probably a future pro. Mikel Jones at linebacker, same type of thing with just having a knack of finding the ball. That's what really drew everybody's attention originally to Andre Sisco, who just got drafted by the Jaguars and is leaving the program early. Jones seems to have that same knack of being a magnet for the football. The other linebackers, Stephon Thompson, Jeff Canton, Arku, they've got to continue on the trend that they were on and continue to get better. If you're a freshman DB stepping in this year, you've got to be Garrett Williams this year. You've got to play above your means. I think the defensive line has some experience there, so that'll be the leadership aspect of the field in that group.
All right, real quick before we let you go, Dallin and I both, I think, are curious. Have you bought any of Buddy Boeheim's online apparel? That'd be number one. And number two, is it going to be Buddy and Jimmy on the floor next year? And are you just going to call them Buddy and Jimmy, not Boeheim to Boeheim?
I guess we'll have to figure that out when we go. The last name won't suffice in that one. And, you know, I think I've known Buddy since he was 3 years old. So I'm not paying for a kid's T-shirt if I've known him since he was running around in diapers. He wants me to wear one. He can give me one. Sell it out for it. But he's a great kid and popular for a reason.
Here's Mark Packer and Wes Durham.
By the way, I talked to Mark yesterday. On the road to recovery, doing better. We don't have a timeline for his return. I know he posted yesterday. It's been a long road, and he is grateful, as he said in his tweet yesterday, for all the love and support to get the Pac-Man back. And I promise you, friends, when he comes back, he'll have things to say. He will have things to say. When you go 2.5 weeks, you got things to say. You know, the old notepad. He hauls out the notepad every once in a while, shows you the notepad. He will have things to say when he gets back. So we're looking forward to Mark's return here in the near future. All right, let's go to the draft tomorrow night. Coverage over on ESPN. Dallin, I look at this and my head starts swimming a little bit on the mocks and all this other stuff. It looks like the highest rated, highest thought of player from the ACC that will go tomorrow night is Scotty Barnes, somewhere 5, 6, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah, I think Scotty pretty much the highest he'd go is 5, which is great. And that's he was a top 10 recruit. Our ESPN had him as the 5th best recruit coming into the class. He was expected to be one and done. And he overperformed expectations, honestly, in my mind, transitioning from a guy that didn't play point guard to playing point guard at the collegiate level. At 6'9", in the NBA, he can guard 1 through 5. That has tremendous positional versatility. He obviously has great vision, a great feel for the game. He's remarkably selfless, as all Noles are under Leonard Hamilton. But he really is one as a superstar that was more than happy to play his role within that team. And I think at Orlando Magic, at number 5 is the highest he can go. The top 4 kind of locked in. Cade Cunningham's going to go first. Jalen Green from G League Ignite is probably going to go second. Evan Mobley out of USC is 3rd. Jalen Suggs from Gonzaga is 4th. That top 4 is kind of locked in and most likely in that order. Scotty seems most likely to go to Orlando, staying in Florida, and giving them a foundational piece to build around that is just a great young man that has absolutely huge potential and a very, very high floor. He's going to be a very contributing member. The question is how good he will be. He's not going to be a bust.
All right, so Scotty Barnes is the highest regarded. The most mysterious of ACC players tomorrow night in the draft is one who didn't play very much at all in the ACC, and that's Jalen Johnson, who played a freshman campaign at Duke.
Yeah, completely enigmatic, and that's because he left after February 13th, that final game. They beat NC State, and he doesn't come back to Duke. And says he wants to get ready for the NBA draft. Remember, IMG Academy left there as well as a high school player. So there are questions about how he's made up, some of those intangibles, his desire to want to be part of and be a cog in a team, to play a role. He's tried to quell those. Poor P.J. Hall. Good Lord, guys. We've shown this play 10,000 times on ESPN and ACC Network. P.J., I'm sorry, man. I know you're going to see in the draft, too. That I feel bad for you every time you see yourself getting dunked on there. But you're going to see yourself Thursday night, get dunked on again, just a heads up in the draft coverage. But Jalen, he's a good player. He's 6'9". He can get the ball off the rim and go coast to coast. He's got playmaking ability for his size. He needs to be having a more consistent shot. Doesn't love a lot of contact. And defensively, he can get lost. So there are holes within his game and questions within his game, but questions within his makeup too. I mean, bear in mind, this time last year, Wes, he was thought of as being a top five draft pick. On our big board, he was fourth on our board. Yep. They now mocking him at 18th to go to Oklahoma City. And then that, they're even calling it a flyer because Oklahoma City has, what, 7 first-round draft picks the next couple years. They're willing to take a flyer on Jalen Johnson, mm-hmm. which it kind of is in my mind right now. He could be great, and he could be a bust. I think he's the biggest delta between what he could be on either end of anybody in that first round.
All right, I want to take a couple of other guys whose stock appears to be moving north. One is Trey Murphy of Virginia, gifted shooter, guy who came into the program. And I got to be honest with you, Dallin, I thought he was very, very good for Tony Bennett. He was a nice fit for what Virginia did. Maybe his numbers fluctuated a little too much, I'm not sure. But I like Trey Murphy at the next level. I almost sense him as a role guy, like a prominent role guy, off the bench, give you 15 minutes type guy.
He might be more than that, Wes, because how the game is played at the NBA, 3-and-D guys hitting threes and defending are of the utmost value on the wing. And it's 6'9 with a 7-foot-plus wingspan, a high vertical, 43% or something, the three-point line, like, and he can do it with range, so the NBA line is not going to affect him at all. And they have loved what they've seen from him. And granted, the college game is different than the NBA game. And with Tony Bennett, you know he's gonna be selfless. He's going to be a good young man. Obviously, transferred from Rice. He's going to know how and understand how to guard. So his basketball IQ is great. You add in the actual skill set, coupled with his physical talent. I think he kind of jumped up to a lot of people because you didn't necessarily see it all the time in Charlottesville. You see it now, and I think he could have a really, really good career in the NBA and being one of those guys that can play in a playoff series at a relatively young age, like Mikal Bridges did, the Villanova guy, similar type of program. We saw him playing with the Suns to come in and have that type of 3-and-D impact.
All right, now I want to go with a guy who I thought had a pro body a year ago and apparently has delivered not just in the combine but now in these individual workouts, and that's Dayron Sharpe of North Carolina. A lot of people excited apparently about Sharpe's progress, especially when they get him one-on-one.
Yeah, they love his personality. He's boisterous, he's outgoing, he's fun, he's hungry to learn, and again, understands how to learn, has a very underrated skill set that I think as teams got to see him and work him out, realize that he's not just this back-to-the-basket guy. He can knock down a jump shot. He's actually extended that out to close to an NBA three-point line. So when you can space the floor like that, that's of way more value, especially in the NBA. He's cut 20 pounds off his body. You mentioned his NBA body. He's explosive. He's a quick jumper. He's got great timing on both ends of the floor at both baskets. But now he shaves some of that, if you will, body baby fat a little bit. He's cutting up a little bit. That is even more impressive. So I think they really like what Dayron Sharpe can be, as the skills seem to catch up with all the skills on the court, catch up with a lot of the physical talents he already had and the way he's wired as a young man mentally. He's got a lot of pieces that a lot of teams like. He may end up going, he might creep into the top 20s. A lot of teams like him from 20 to 25, but I think he'll be a guy that can be a great energy guy off the bench. And if he can develop a jump shot, he may end up, even more so, he may end up being like Bobby Portis, who played for the Bucks and was part of that national champion, that world championship team. At Arkansas. So that could be like a huge ceiling for him if he can consistently start to knock down a three. That's years away. But right now, his mechanics are good, and he's showing he can knock down a shot, which is real critical. And his passing interior and the interior, too, is very good.
Dallin, it seems like we've kind of pivoted to a little bit of this today. How important is the fact he's gone in with the right attitude and the right personality for this process, and teams have been able to see that one-on-one?
It's huge, man. And I think, like, Wes, I think people underestimate the intangibles and how important they are, especially in the NBA draft, because this is all a futures market. I mean, he's 19 years old. Almost all these guys we're talking about outside of, you know, Trey Murphy, like, in terms of a lot of the guys across the draft, they're between 18 and 20. And you need to try to understand what type of young man you have here. What does he value? What does his family like? What did his coaches say about him? And not coaches saying to us when the cameras are on, let's be real here. Because when the cameras aren't on, sometimes you'll get the real deal on what these guys actually think the players are made up of and what they're capable of at the next level.
That's right.
So that's what these GMs are getting, and that's what they're trying to understand these front offices. It is a really hard thing to do. But there are certain guys you know you can feel it. And I think they felt that from Dayron Sharpe. You know it from Scottie Barnes, and you've heard that from everybody that's been around Scottie since he's 15 years old, the type of young man that he is and the type of man he will become. And he's on that path already. So I think those things, they really play into it. And lastly, how competitive people are. People forget, like, Jalen Suggs, the kid from Gonzaga, I think he'll probably go fourth at Toronto. There may not be a more competitive kid in this draft. I mean, that dude is tough. He's tenacious. Right. He'll do anything to win, and he's remarkably talented. When you have those type of things and those type of intangibles and you're separating really small margins in terms of skill level, that stuff matters. And that stuff really pans out when you're dealing with the top 0.01% of what people do at the NBA.
The Packer and Durham Podcast.